transmitiendo desde la Universidad de Columbia en Nueva York. Esto es Procrastinando, un programa de filosofía del derecho con un carácter totalmente informal.
My eyes adored you, though I never laid a hand on you. My eyes adored you, like a million miles away from me, you couldn't see how I adored you. So close, so close, and yet so far. Hit it for city lights, climbed the ladder up to fortune and fame. Worked my fingers to the bone, made myself a name. Funny I seem to find that no matter how the years unwind, still I reminisce about the girl I miss and the love I left behind.
Buenos días, Universidad Nacional Autónoma de México. Buenos días, Facultad de Derecho. Buenos días, gente de México. Hoy tenemos un gran privilegio de poder platicar con la doctora Gayatri Spivak aquí en la Universidad de Columbia y poder conversar ella sobre su teoría y aspectos generales de ella. Welcome, Professor Spivak.
Okay, one thing I should say, me llamo Gayatri Chakravorty Spivak.
Yes.
Not just Gayatri Spivak. Yeah. That, you know, professionally, yeah. I have to.
Okay, thank you.
I have to keep the whole name.
Yes. Doctor, I told you once I got in here in your office that I was surprised at all the books you have here. You have Sigmund Freud, you have Goethe, you have Fitzgerald,
Gramsci's notebooks,
Gramsci, Marx, and law books. What are the main sources of your thought?
It's hard to say, you know, because I read theory as if it's creative writing. For not instrumentalizing it, thinking, how can I apply this? Because I am a literary person, and I was given a very thorough education at the University of Calcutta in literary reading. I think of it as imaginative activism. So because I read theory in this way, as if I'm writing the book, it gets internalized. So when I begin to read, I don't know who is influencing me. Sources of thought? I think other people can probably say this better than I can. If they pay attention to my thought, they can tell me by whom I'm influenced. I think that I'm reading. You know what I mean? As to what made my head or my heart. It's hard for me to say.
Some people say that you're a Marxist. Do you think yourself as a Marxist?
Yes. I think of Marx as my brother. I do think that it is not possible to remain faithful to the text. That's not, just as I said, that's not my way. And you know that I come from a state which has had a left front government now for 34 years. They've just lost the elections, and we're hoping that they will win again and that the party will reform itself some.
Yes.
But in West Bengal, to be on the left was, in fact, to be normal. So therefore, that question doesn't come to me in terms of US Marxism, which is a very different kind of thing, and not Western Marxism either. I mean, I have very recently written a review of a book by Vivek Chibber where I've talked about Little Britain Marxism. You know, not Great Britain, but Little Britain. And this is something that I've thought for many, many years. And then there's also, you know, sort of bourgeois revolution Marxism, where my very dear friend Etienne Balibar, in his recent book on the philosophy of Marxism, says Marxism is an improbable, and I quote, improbable philosophy. And he says that Marx did not have the time to give us doctrine because he was busy rectifying himself. Whereas for me, that's what makes Marx interesting. It's an open text right at the, I mean, when Engels collected his materials And Capital Volume 3, as you know, is where Marx contradicted himself from Capital 1. It's the thickest volume. And then at the end of his life, because he was persuaded that just Germany and Britain wasn't giving him enough of a critical base, he started learning Russian, because Russia was such a very different social formation. That's the kind of Marx, that's why I said he's my brother. Yeah. That's the kind of Marx that I feel extremely close to. And I'm not a post-Marxist. And also Gramsci's reading, where he says that Marx's work is gnoseological, which is translated as epistemological in English, but that's not quite the word. I'm much invested in that opening up of Marx into a conjuncture which already was different from his, and Gramsci had a tremendous political imagination. And then, of course, moving into our own time. So yes, I remain an active kind of Marxist rather than someone who follows a line.
Yes. When you wrote your book of Critical of Postcolonial Reason, Terry Eagleton criticized you. But a part of the critics, I believe, is quite interested, because he said that you are more worried about the epistemological matters than the whole construction on the formalities.
I don't remember Terry's review in detail, so I will simply take you at your word that he said so. But I'll tell you why I'm interested in epistemological details. Because it seems to me, unless desires are shifted, no permanent political structures will come into being. I'll give you some examples. You see, when in Capital One, Marx, as you well know, everybody knows that that book was really vetted. Many people suggested and helped and so on and so forth. And it was written for the implied reader is the working class. And basically, there is an epistemological challenge there. Change your own, how you construct yourself as an object of knowledge, from victim of capitalism to agent of production. Now, unless there are these, and I've been working with the landless illiterate now, training them, giving time and skill, and also money, but that's a different thing. I don't accept funding because I don't want to be evaluated by people who have no idea as to what it is that one is trying to do.
Yes.
So, and there, in order to bring in will to law, unless you, I mean, these are people who see nothing but ruling class corruption all around them, and who have been for millennia cognitively damaged by my caste, my class. Unless the mental furniture with which the world is understood is shifted, there is no way that there will be, and this is true also at the top. I mean, I have students here who are ready to help the world. So this undertaking is hard and slow. And Eagleton supposedly is a teacher of literature.
Yes.
He should know that this is where the kind of vanguardist line, you know, like the vanguard will change class consciousness or bring class consciousness to the masses, etc. People should realize that those kinds of sentences, in fact, also have an epistemological burden. I mean, you know, class consciousness, where does the word consciousness come from? So to an extent, I think Eagleton should do his homework. I like him very much. He's an old friend. But nonetheless, you know, he shoots off too easily.
And what other of, I believe, if you may say so, of your brothers is Jacques Derrida. You start working with Derrida, you translate the grammatology, and you told me that you are doing the retranslation again.
Yes.
Of the grammatology. Derrida once said that the construction was a strategy. It shouldn't be like a recipe. When some people think I do A, B, and C, and then I got the answer. It's a strategy. For you, how does this strategy work?
Again, you know, I will go back to my first answer. I mean, these are important questions, so yes. I'm trying to answer, you know, in the way in which generations of my students have heard me answer. See, I don't really know how to deconstruct. What I was taken by when I first read the La Grammatologie, and I have said many times that I did not know who Derrida was. I just ordered the book out of a catalogue, because this was before email, before faxes, not quite before faxes, but before faxes became so popular, before the internet. And so, and I was in the middle of the country. So I thought he was an unknown author, you know, and I read the book with my limited French, which is why I'm also revising the translation. I knew very little French. So, and even now, I've only had one little course, but nonetheless. But what I liked very much was that on the first page was the word ethnocentrism. Nobody used that word in 67 in books of philosophy. I thought, my God, look at this guy. I was much taken. So I followed him through his book, and I saw the word deconstruction. And I was not really, I didn't know how to do it, okay? I could understand what he was writing. And then I was just, my way of thinking, humble as it was, nurtured by my teachers, was, it resonated with his, you know? And when I say resonated, that's a musical metaphor, right? And I'm thinking of the German word Bestimmung. Because in the middle, I mean, that determination, it's translated into English, but right in the center of it is the word Stimme, voice, sound, music, if you know what I mean. Yeah. So we rang together, as it were, and therefore, I always went to all of his lectures and talks because he surprised me every time. I could not make the moves he made, okay? And so, as a literary person, what does a literary person do? She learns how to welcome the contingent, not the necessary. This nice is why definition. All literary studies, you know, genres and so on, they are ready to be broken down by new literature or new readings of old literature any day. And that's what happened between Jacques and me. You see, it wasn't like I became a deconstructor. No, because for me, he was a new writer, you know. I mean, I met him when, and I've never had a philosophy course in my entire life, undergraduate, graduate. I met him when he was not yet quite that famous. He was 41 years old. And it was like an adventure, you know what I mean? Marx is a little bit different because he's in our history, the history of Bengal. I mean, you know that the Communist Party of Mexico had something to, its establishment had something to do with a guy called M.N. Roy, who was a Bengali.
Yes.
Right? So because our left tradition is old, and so that, therefore that was a bit different. It was almost like a family thing. My mother's brother was a member of the Legislative Assembly from the old Communist Party of India. So that's not quite exactly. He gave a Capital One to me when I was 15.
Yes.
Whereas Derrida, it was not something I was expecting. It changed my entire life, but it was the contingent.
And for you, you are one of the major scholars on post-colonial theory. But somehow, talking about post-colonial theory has become complex. And nobody understands clearly what is the post in post-colonial theory. So I feel that I'm obligated to ask you, what is post-colonial theory for you?
Well, first I can make a joke.
Yes.
You see, if I am influenced by deconstruction,
yes,
then I have no answers for ontophenomenological questions. That is to say, what is?
Yes.
Okay? But that's a joke, you know. But deconstructive thinking always turns it, since theory, to theorize is a practice. It would tell you, what is it to be postcolonial, you know? That's the form. But I'm only half serious. You see, the thing was that I was born in British India, right? And at first for us, the word postcolonial was almost a joke. it was a deeply ironic word, because for, I mean, my generation is the first generation of full-fledged intellectuals after independence, you know, because Salman Rushdie, they are Midnight's children. They were born in 1947, the year of independence. We were born before. And we felt that the failure of decolonization began when negotiated independence came in, because necessarily colonized countries have no practice of freedom, and therefore that's the formula. So we could not be serious about claiming post-coloniality as anything but a descriptive adjective, and like most descriptive adjectives, it's very limited. Also in our subcontinent, India inherited the British railway system, the Indian army trained by the British, etc., etc., whereas Pakistan and what was then East Pakistan, Western East Pakistan, had to start from scratch, so that those of us who thought about these things also felt that post-coloniality was not shared the same way in the different post-independence nation states. So all of this. Then, in the late 1970s, something that happens in the United States to well-placed metropolitan intellectuals, immigrant intellectuals, happened, which is a kind of crisis of conscience, very peculiar to the United States, because there is in the United States there this tendency of self-criticism, which in a sense legitimizes the U.S. by reversal. It is serious and sincere, but it is in the long run symptomatic. So I went through it. And that was, you know, because I had read Jane Eyre, for example, as a teenager in India many times, it had never occurred to me that there was in it this Creole person who had been completely, the mad woman who had been completely trashed almost as an animal, etc. So this kind of thing, which happens in the United States, which to an extent legitimizes its kind of imperial role. I mean, this is a very peculiar thing I'm saying. This happened to me, this happened to Homi, this happened to Edward, and so on and so forth. And then I had this thing of how can it be that I have become the specialist of French feminism and of deconstruction. All of this is very US and in a deep way autobiographical. Out of this came writing, which was later called post-colonial. I certainly did not connect that with the experience of post-coloniality as an Indian citizen. I mean, I'm still an Indian citizen. I just voted in Calcutta. This is, see, my nail has grown that much since yes. May 12th. You know, so that post-colonial is a completely different kind of thing. It's a historical thing. And it's a kind of failure, and it's failing more and more. But the thing is, new nations. But this here thing, the other thing that you're describing, U.S. post-colonialism, when I saw that what I had written under this kind of, I look back upon it, as I say, symptomatic autobiographical moment, was being welcomed as post-colonial, I immediately became its critic. That's why that book is called Critique of Post-Colonial Reason. And Amartya Sen, who was on the syndics of the Harvard University Press, whom I know very well, obviously, he's kind of a homeboy, as they say in U.S. English. He said to me, Gayatri, this is a serious book. Why do you have a frivolous title? Because I had given it the title, Don't Call Me Postcolonial! ! And so I said, well, what should I call it? He said, well, you've got a reading of Kant in the first chapter. should call it critique of postcolonial reason. I said, well, if you say so, seems a bit too vain to me.
Too arrogant.
Yeah. But if you think so, I'll do it. So therefore, my relationship, I mean, people have not paid any attention to the fact that I have never really been seriously self-declared post-colonial. And in fact, the essay of mine, which is unfortunately best known, is not a post-colonial essay. It's a critique of Hindus.
Yes.
Can the subaltern speak? It's a critique of the Hindu tradition.
Yeah.
It's not
how they read literature.
Not only how they read literature, but how they treated women.
Yes.
You know, it's a...
It's interesting when I read yourself and I read Professor Baba, they're both Indians, but they don't go to the same point. You write in different directions. At some point, both theories split and one go other ways. Why do you think it's...
But how do you mean? First of all, explain yourself a little,
yes,
then I'll answer.
Professor Baba goes more to the... not to the literature, not to the epistemological questions, but go to the sociological matters, the difference in politics and society. But you rarely talk about politics, rarely talk about how society lives, not how society reads. Why do you think is that?
I don't really know. I mean, there is a difference between Homi and me because, as I say, I am Indian,
yes,
right? So, I mean, I'm a critic of the Republic of India. And I can't just... I mean, I'm not a minority in either a little island off the coast of France where Homi was, Britain. He's a British citizen. Now, I suppose he's U.S. I think it does matter to what civil society you're attached. And I'm not a minority here. I have no civil rights. That's fine. I teach. You know, I'm part of a majority, sometimes violent, of a very large country, 86% majority. That's me.
Yes.
So therefore, I think I can't... You will notice that most of Homi's political material, very beautifully argued,
yes,
is for the marginalized. But I'm not marginalized. I'm an upper caste Hindu. I've been an instrument of marginalization now for thousands of years. So it's very hard for me to ask for political redress on my behalf or on behalf of upper-class metropolitan migrants. I would have run for national office in that case.
One of the later books you wrote is about education and teaching, which is very, very beautiful. And you talk about aesthetic education. When I read the title, I must confess, I went back to Walter Benjamin. And you start by defining what is aesthetic. I don't know if you can talk us about what is aesthetic for you.
Well, now, first of all, Benjamin. You know that I don't know if you have read the book to the end. It's a big book. But right at the end, I say that I wanted to call this book An Aesthetic Education in the Era of Globalizability.
Yes.
That's Benjamin, the
yes,
Bakite, you know?
Yes.
And so it has a very deep connection to Benjamin, but not in the aesthetic business, but in the globalizability. Hmm? Anything can be globalized now, so therefore, what do we do? Aesthetic, you know, I mean, my way is not to offer definitions, because theory, I think, is a halfway house, and it is always normed by practice, and theorizing is itself a practice, and so therefore, if you offer definitions, you will offer them to be broken.
You say that in Subalt, in Candace.
I'm sure,
speak.
To be used and then to be broken. Yes. So therefore, what I do is I offer a kind of rule of thumb. I use the word aesthetic as a kind of citation, right? Because I'm dealing with what kind of mistake should one make with Kant? The Schillerian mistake or some other kind of mistake? Because a mistake is called for. Kant himself made the mistake quite deliberately because philosophizing, which is never defined in Kant except as something impossible, is undertaken. So therefore, that's the critical tradition for me. And so therefore, I have to take the word aesthetic because I'm citing, iterating Schiller's book, Aesthetic Education, right? So, but I am talking about aesthetic education in terms of imaginative training for epistemological performance. That is to say, you change the way you know what you are going to know, object of knowledge. And I've given one example already about the changing from victim of capitalism to agent of production. Another example that I give is, you know, the mother thinks the mother thinks honor, and the daughter thinks reproductive rights. It's an epistemological change. So that's what aesthetic education is. It's not everything. There has to be other kinds of education. But for me, without this, it's not going to. So did everything come back? Mm-hmm. Okay, wonderful. And is that out there?
No, it's in the room.
Ah, beautiful. Yeah. I'm very sorry. You see, that's life. You did meet, right?
Yeah.
So life comes into the conversation. Okay, bye-bye. Tomorrow. Yes.
You use a very beautiful term in that book, which is imaginative training.
Well, that I just used
it. Yes, yes. I believe that in most of your books, you do that. Particularly in the book, Critical Postcolonial Reason, when you talk about Frankenstein, about how we can understand it in another way, and how we can understand the woman's position about compared to Frankenstein the monster.
I see that as the task of the literary teacher. And you know, the literary for me has a very, very big meaning. It's a meaning, it's not a definition, but it's something I work by and with. It is the ability to be suspended in someone else's web of being, thinking, acting, etc., be woven into someone else's web. You know, and I'm using the word web for texere, textile, right? Because if you say text, people think it's like words in a book. But web, World Wide Web, so, you know, yes. to an extent. That is, for me, imaginative training. And you see, there is one kind of imaginative training about which I don't write, because I'm really learning there still after 30 years, which is the work with the largest sector of the electorate in India. And that, 30 years of time and skill, but the answers are not yet clear to me. Just now, for example, I'm engaged in a certain kind of agricultural work. Okay, I don't want to specify very much more because it's not happened yet. I've talked to officers, this, that. Yes. What I found to begin with was that the guy there I have six schools, has had only 4 years of education, but extremely smart and wanting to be a leader. Unfortunately, that's the person I have trained least, because I train teachers. And someone who has had 4 years of education, only elementary school, is not among the teachers. So he's also impatient and he's not there. I give very long training sessions. He's not there. On the other hand, he's leaderly. So therefore, all the women and men over whom I have lavished my training in order to learn how to train them, because their epistemologies have been damaged over thousands of years, they are led by this person who has not been imaginatively trained by me over these last 30 years, right? I mean, he's my friend. I ride on his motorcycle, but I'm not he's not sitting there when I'm kind of training desperately to see how can I get to them. And so this, the agricultural thing that I'm talking about, resembles the bad stuff that they see all around them. So that it resembles the, it is a desire to be small latifundists and use the other so-called untouchable castes and aboriginals as sharecroppers in their small little latifundia. You understand?
Yes.
And so, on the other hand, the ones that I have trained, they know that there's something wrong with this. Because for 30 years I've been trying to train their imagination to think of the Indian poor as one, equal but not the same, right? And not be prejudiced against all of these different kinds of caste groups that exist on the subaltern level. People don't ever think about this or talk about it or anything. And so I have come face to face with this, and now for a couple of months these conversations are taking place. Okay. Now, and I'm there all the time, right? When I went to, I'm a Rosa Luxemburg-style social democrat, all right? So I'm not an anarchist. So, and I think it's a kind of elite, I'm not Bakunin, I'm reading Bakunin again, and it's amazing the difference between him and Marx, who's still, and then Luxemburg is revising them at the beginning of the Massenstreich. And anyway, so I go to the survey office, okay? I'm a citizen after all. And this guy, the guy who's now in the survey office, is in fact a man whom I have known since he was the lowest level civil service worker. He has an MA in political economy from my university, University of Calcutta. And the guy who taught him has written on my stuff. So this guy, it still thinks, this guy in the survey office. So he's like incredibly excited by what is happening in this agricultural thing that I'm not telling you anything in detail. And so he's calling. And then I say, hey, hold it, because the people are not yet quite prepared, eh? So, because this is what came out first. And so he's saying, oh, so you haven't done the work. And then I said, hold it. When I write, you've read my work in English. When I write the sentence, institutional change is neither isomorphic nor isotemporal with subject formation. What do you think I'm talking about? You think I'm different? Because we are speaking in Bengali, yes. Right? You think I'm different when I'm working in those villages from what I write in a sentence in a book of theory written in English? Didn't you pay any attention to this? That's what I'm talking to you about.
Yes.
It's not that, that's imaginative training, see what I mean? And so it takes time. That's all.
Yeah.
This long example I gave you, because you won't find it in a book. Because if I start writing about this for academics, then I will myself not be able to learn anything. I have to remain focused in order to learn how to do this.
Actually, you say there is a writing in, you wrote about who will educate the educators.
Yeah, but
you,
that's Marx.
Yeah, you retake Marx. And you say that it's not, as Marx said, it's not only important reform in teaching, but in learning. That's the important matter.
I may have said it. I mean, you know, I don't remember everything I have written, so I'm sure I said it. Sounds like me.
And the other question is, you wrote a very famous book, which is Can the Subaltern Speak? And most people I have talked with them, they don't know if you say they can speak or they can't speak. So I have to make the question, can the subaltern speak?
Well, that's why I kept it a question, first of all. And I did say in there, the subaltern cannot speak. Okay? There are many things to be said about this. It was a statement of anguish, anger, and despair, because the story was that the woman who hanged herself because she could not kill, you know, she was in an anti-imperialist struggle and she had been given an assassination detail. She could not kill, and so she did what the group required, she killed herself. But she waited until she menstruated to show that she was not killing herself because she was illicitly pregnant. In other words, it was a declaration in the body, writing the body to say, I am a feminist. I am not identified with a man as all those women who were burnt with their husbands were. I am against that. She spoke in extremis with her body. And yet, a woman in her own family, just two generations later, highly educated, said she had killed herself because of an illicit pregnancy. So therefore, it was a rhetorical and emotional remark. Anybody who reads the text should know it. It was an emotional remark saying, the subaltern may even write with her body and speak in death, but even then we cannot complete their speech act. Therefore, she cannot speak.
It's like in the Scarlet Letter.
Well, I would not like to compare it to a text because, that's like, yeah. That's a book that's read in American studies and people take exams on this, whereas this is a very obscure 17-year-old woman. I would like to keep her apart. Yeah. But, and people don't understand my text because I tell her story. It's amazing. And I'll also say something. Meghan Morris told Dipesh Chakraborty. Now, I don't know that she actually said it because Dipesh told me that those who think that Gayatri is silencing the subaltern think that she wrote an essay called Can the Subaltern Talk? Not Can the Subaltern Speak? Yeah. Because there is a difference between the two damn things.
Yes.
Of course, they not only can they speak, they speak. And this woman spoke in the most extreme way. But we do not have an infrastructure which allows us to recognize that speech has taken place.
When I just knew you, I told you that many students in the philosophy faculty read your work, and somehow they resent that you don't talk much about Latin America. And I guess I have to make the question, maybe you don't have the answer for it, but how do you feel about this theory of the subaltern when we see the story of the migrant kids, these kids that are crossing the border without parents and maybe risking their lives?
I think the idea of the subaltern is very mobile. I don't, and in fact, that woman about whom I wrote 30 years ago, I didn't particularly think that she was a pure example of subalternity. I mean, I moved away from her, and I, since then, since 1986, I've been involved in producing the subaltern intellectual in those schools, which is Gramsci's program. I mean, I wasn't following Gramsci, like I told you earlier.
Yes.
I found much later, I've been teaching Gramsci forever, and then about 3 or 4 years ago when I was teaching Gramsci, I realized that his thinking, again, resonated in a very important way. So yes, I think the idea of subalternity can be used to describe different kinds of situations and situations that are not generalizable by capital logic alone. I stick to that because that's where Gramsci had to go there, because he was, after all, the director of the Communist Party. It wasn't like he wasn't a communist. But he realized that in the Italy of his day, if you just defined the work in terms of the proletariat alone, there would be a huge task undone. And that's why it became so interesting for the Indians, because they're also colonialism and capitalism are not quite the same thing. There can be capitalist colonialism, but there are very subtle differences. And so the idea of the subaltern came in handy. But the idea of the subaltern is certainly movable. It goes all over the place. I mean, the Occupy Wall Street guys, yes, that subalternization, right? I mean, removal from the structures of the welfare state. That is also a certain kind of subalternization. So subaltern doesn't describe a poor person. It doesn't describe an oppressed person. It does not describe a marginal person. It's a very specific thing. It's a position without identity, and it is a separation from any of the structures of social redress and an impossibility for struggle to be recognized as such. These are things, and I will say this, we are not interested in preserving subalternity. Subalternity should be destroyed, you know, yeah, so that it can be constantly inserted into the circuit of an active citizenship. It's a very different ballgame. This is why so-called paperless immigrants are absolutely the new subaltern, not just their children. Children, of course, children even more. But so, yes, the idea of the subaltern is a useful idea that can travel all over the place.
You are a quite prestigious feminist, or defender of the feminism. But the word feminism is complex. What is feminism for you?
On to phenomenological question.
You cannot answer.
Okay. I tell you, we're speaking in English.
Yes.
So I'm using the word feminism because I think the word womanism that was made up by certain really fairly elite intellectuals combating so-called Eurocentrism, that was about as Eurocentric as you can be. I mean, all these self-declared combating of Eurocentrism, they really legitimize Eurocentrism. Because, you know, when you work among the subaltern, you find that Eurocentrism is not an issue. There are many other very important issues. But, I mean, it makes no sense to speak about Eurocentrism. So, speaking in English here in my nicely appointed office, we are using that English word. You know, we use the word Marxism. It's like that. And I think it would be very difficult to give a definition of feminism, because feminism does not have a big book. You know what I mean?
Yes.
So, and I think it's good that way. And I, in fact, have never been identified with single-issue feminism. Because single-issue feminism, whether it wants to or not, takes the middle-class woman, even if it is working for a very poor woman, takes the middle-class woman as the example of woman, and I think that's a mistake. Also, in many, many cases, incredible violence against women comes because, and I know what I'm talking about, I've been doing this now for 30 years. I've been teaching at a US university for 49 years, but I've been teaching among the landless illiterate, teaching and training now for 30 years. And quite often, the men and the women who take rape culture and bribe culture as normal do so because of deep class apartheid in education. And so to separate it as kind of a just a gender thing is a luxury. And I will say this also, that working in South Asia, especially because that's a place where I'm a citizen, for women who suffer HIV, AIDS, trafficking, etc., public mock courts of South Asia, juries, it is quite surprising how often the immediate agent of trafficking is a woman. So my idea of something innate in women that somehow keeps them pure, that's ridiculous. I think, in fact, if you work among the subaltern, you cannot keep women and men separate. And at the same time, you must, of course, also criticize very deeply the kind of historical resentment of women that there is in the men. I mean, you would laugh if you heard me talk
yes.
to these guys with whom I work, with their 7 years of education and high school graduate education, etc. And I say, look, I know what I'm talking about. People resent me because I'm a woman. I'm not so, you know, you folks, I mean, here we are all together, and I'm your teacher, and I'm your older sister, and this and that. But as men, you have a certain degree of resentment of me because I have some power over you. Think about it, you know, etc. I have these long talks with these uneducated men. So it is quite true that, you know, you have to look at this kind of inbuilt heteronormativity. But on the other hand, if in the field of action you're a single-issue feminist, I think, again, that's very symptomatic of a certain class production.
Well, I guess this is the last question. What should we expect? What are you working now to present in the next years? You told me about the grammatology, the new translation you're working, which is going to be interesting, is this rewriting. But where are you working?
Well, I'm working on many fronts. I'll just give you a very short list.
Yes.
I have a book on W.B. Du Bois. I gave the Du Bois lectures at Harvard in 2009. And I am discovering more and more how much he changed. I think he was really the most important historian sociologist in the United States in the 20th century. He's not considered in that way because he is African American. He was African American. But really, we should not stop with de Tocqueville. He talks about the constitution of democracy in the United States in a way that's absolutely masterful. So I go to Ghana in Africa to read the books that he took with himself when he became a citizen of Ghana right at the end. So I'm looking at his marginalia and so on. So that's like a book. And I'm also very deeply involved with working with Africans in Ghana, Nigeria, and Kenya on the mother tongues that were not consolidated by the missionaries as survival languages, not as endangered languages or anything. That takes up a great deal of my time. And I'm also, of course, working on this these schools that I'm talking about.
Okay.
You see, that's the biggest challenge in my life.
And beautiful.
That's the biggest challenge because it's an intellectual problem of massive proportions.
It's getting the practice.
Is it possible to access? Remember what I said, the literary was getting suspended in someone else's web. Is it possible to access an epistemology cognitively damaged over thousands of years with no right to intellectual labor punished, only bred up for manual labor and obedience and saying yes? Is it possible to access an epistemic apparatus in order to teach the children the intuitions of democracy, that is to say, the most hospitable of systems, where you have to feel the aporia, the double bind between liberty, autonomy, myself, ipseity, and equality, which is this, even those who are completely different from me, even thieves and jerks and murderers, are equal, one vote. That's a huge aporia. Is it possible? Because all the human rights stuff is just doing their justified self-interest. I'm not interested in that. I'm a teacher. This is an enormous, I mean, this is a kind of supplementing of vanguardism, especially since it is my caste and class that have done this. Post-colonial is nothing compared to this. There was day before yesterday. These guys have not seen white folks. I mean, they don't have any sense of colonialism, but in terms of the longue durée, Brodel, in terms of the persistent structures, they know about caste oppression completely. And so I tell them, you know, I'm your race enemy, your class enemy. I'm here to repay my ancestral debt. But on the other hand, I'm like a good person. My parents were also good. What do you think two generations are in the context of 5,000 years? Don't trust me and stop needing me, because I'm not your friend, I'm your enemy. So, you know, this work, I mean, it's unbelievably challenging. And I can't write books about it. Yes. Because if I do, first of all, I have no method to give anyone. The subaltern is not generalizable. And what method will I give? Will they do it? It is very difficult to do. They won't do anything. So I'm still learning. And that's, of course, that's my work, which I have no idea what it will lead to. But so there's the Du Bois book, all these African thingies, and the
workshop, your work.
This other work.
Well, Dr. Spivak, has been a pleasure to talk with you. As I told you before, I'm very excited of knowing you and talking to you about your books. I'm a big fan of your work. Thank you very much.
Thank you for coming. It's been fun. Miles adored you, though I never laid a hand on you. My eyes adored you, like a million miles away from me. You couldn't see how I adored you. So close, so close, and yet so far. My eyes adored you, though I never laid a hand on you. My eyes adored you, like a million miles away from me. You couldn't see how I adored you. So close, so close, and yet so far. So close, so close, and yet so far. Thank you.